Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Change Your Mind podcast, where we explore personal development, spirituality, and science. I'm your host, Chris Ashley, and I am so excited for my guest today. If you are in business or looking to get into business, you definitely want to tune into this episode. But first, a couple quick announcements. Head over to the links in the show notes. You are going to find ways to sponsor the podcast. You're going to find a link to my book, Change Your Mind to Change Your Reality. You'll find links for my courses, free downloads, and of course, all of my guest links as well. And as always, this podcast is part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network. We are doing massive things in personal development. That is where I met my guest. We were just live at Barnes & Noble at The Grove in LA just last month. So check us out. There's so many amazing podcasts in the network. We're doing such incredible work. Come be a part of the community. What if the one thing keeping you stuck is the way you think? Welcome to Change Your Mind with Chris Ashley, the podcast where science meets spirituality and mindset becomes your most powerful tool for transformation. I'm Chris Ashley, author of Change Your Mind to Change Your Reality, trainer, speaker, and lifelong seeker. For years, I battled trauma, depression, anger, chronic illness, low self-worth, and the weight of old stories. Until I discovered how to rewire my mind, reconnect with my divine nature, and consciously create a new reality from the inside out. This show is here to help you do the same. Each week, we explore the intersection of personal development, spirituality, and science, diving into topics like healing, emotional mastery, entrepreneurship, resilience, and the quantum nature of reality. You'll hear powerful stories, gain practical tools and real conversations that will help you change your perspective, get unshakable confidence, and live the vision your soul has always known is possible. Whether you're navigating a major life shift, building your dream business, or seeking deep healing and alignment, you're in the right place. So if you're ready to break through, take back your power, and create a life on your terms, this is your moment. Let's break free from the patterns that hold us back, awaken to who we truly are, and rise. Your transformation starts now. All right. So with me today, I have Aaron Scott Young. So Aaron is a distinguished entrepreneur and strategic business advisor who has dedicated over four decades to empowering others to build and protect their dreams. He is the chairman and CEO of Laughlin Associates. He's also the creator of The Unshackled Owner, which is a transformative program designed to liberate entrepreneurs from the daily grind, empowering them to build businesses that are not only self-sustaining, but also impactful. I love that. And then recently, he released his fourth book because he's just got that much time on his hands, I guess. Unshackled, The 7 Levels of Business Excellence. This book provides a practical and powerful framework for business leaders, guiding them through common challenges to build successful, sustainable companies that truly change lives for the better. Welcome, Aaron. I'm so happy you're here.
Hi, Chris. It's so nice to be here with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. The pleasure is mine. And I'm so excited. I have so many questions for you. But first, I have to ask you the question that every single guest gets as number one. Okay. And that is, what is your origin story? What put you on this path to create this successful company that you're focused not only on helping people find financial freedom, but also do it in an impactful way?
I started my first company. So I grew up in a family where I had a mom and dad who loved me a lot and thought I was great. I was the oldest of 5 children. And I had phenomenal parents, but no, they didn't have any money. They never knew how to make money. They were always bad with money, especially my dad, bad with money, but yet my hero in every other way, except for financially. And so I just always thought I could do stuff. I'd been told from birth that, of course, if you know somebody's going to do it, why not you? And so when I needed some money as I got a little older, like in high school, I started working in a sort of a contractor way for a guy that owned or managed an apartment complex When I turned 16, I got hired by the owner of that complex to paint his house. And I gave, after we made friends, I'm just 16. And I said, I don't know what you pay your managers to turn these apartments, because I knew I was getting paid $3 an hour. And, but I said, I'll do all your apartment buildings for $10 an hour. And the guy's like, great. So then I hired a bunch of other high school kids to do the work that I'd been doing, very Tom Sawyer, painting the white fence, you know. And I made the, I paid them what I was used to getting paid, actually a little more than I was getting paid before. And I kept the difference. And then I started a business when I was a freshman in college that was a recycling business that turned into something kind of cool. We ended up with three employees. It was really with two founders and two employees and two trucks, two routes, and about 5,000 customers. And then I met my wife when I was 22, and I thought, I don't want to be a garbage man. So I sold my interest in the recycling business to the other guy. I got into the cellular phone business in 1986 and ended up with five locations for the cellular phone industry. And then I got recruited to be at 29 to be the vice president of sales for a company that was getting ready to go public on NASDAQ. They had over 300 offices worldwide. So I found myself at just coming 30 years old as an officer of a publicly traded multinational, and made a lot of money in stock. Under my leadership, we about quadrupled sales worldwide for the company, which did really well in the stock. And so at 32 and a half, 33, I started buying businesses. And along the path, I bought, along with a partner, I bought Laughlin Associates, which is one we've kept, which has many, many thousands of customers. It's been around since 1972. And because we're working on asset protection, strategic tax planning, business compliance, I just meet a lot of good business owners, and that gives me a lot of deal flow opportunities. So that's kind of what my, that's a short version and a simplified version of my story.
Amazing. I think you just froze for a second. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, Chris. Okay. Yeah, I hope we can edit it, but it does. I keep seeing your camera going in and out.
So the thing with Riverside is that it records each of us separately. So the final version is like crystal clear, but yeah, it's annoying.
It's like, okay with me as long as we can hear each other.
Yeah, totally. Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm so impressed that you have been an entrepreneur since you were 16, maybe even younger. And I feel like you just have this drive in you. And I love that it was instilled from your parents, where it's like, there's so many people out there who have self-doubt or self-worth issues. And you're like, no, I was just always told that like I could do anything I wanted. So I did whatever I wanted. I love that. That's so inspirational. So
yeah, it was not a bad way to grow up.
Yeah. And I mean, it's also inspiring as a parent, right? Like that's like to instill that in your children, right? For anyone that's listening, that's a parent. Amazing. All of that. So did you ever have any kind of fear getting started or any kind of doubt as you were starting these businesses? Or was it really just like, I can do everything I want? And there was like just total confidence the whole time.
Okay. Well, I'm 60 years old now.
Okay.
And so I was 19 then. When I started the recycling business, I was still 18, but we didn't go like for real as a company. You know, I was just a sole proprietor, but we became a real company right after I turned 19. So was there any fear? There was no fear at the beginning. There was no fear in selling it. There was no fear in going into the cellular business. There was some fear signing my first lease on a building. There was some fear signing multiple leases because I was very young, you know, and I was just bootstrapping. And I think it was good that I was somewhat ignorant of the risks I was taking, because I just thought, oh, well, this is just what you do next. And so I did it. And there were days or months when I worried about, was the revenue going to be enough to pay the employees? Was I going to get paid? But mostly it went pretty well. And anyway, so that happened. And then probably the scariest thing was being offered that job of the big company, because I felt utterly inadequate to do the job, because I didn't have a college education. I hadn't ever had a job. Other than when I was 14, but by the time I was 16, I was kind of calling my own shots.
Yeah.
And I was used to being in charge and sort of figuring things out as I went. And all of a sudden now I thought, well, I have to be accountable to somebody. And that was intimidating. And I wondered if I would let them down. Letting people down or not, I guess at the deepest level, not being trustworthy, like not doing what I committed to do, is that's one of my biggest drivers in life, is to do what I say I'm going to do. And that was kind of scary, because I didn't really know if I could do it. But lo and behold, it worked out okay.
Yeah. And yeah, it's interesting, that idea of like drive, right? Tony Robbins talks about like having positive drive and like negative, positive influence and negative influence, right? There's like those things that like drive you because you like want them, and those things that drive you because you're like, oh, I don't want that.
Yeah.
So do you feel like what else made you so motivated? Was it just like going after money, or was it just like, what was it?
I still, by most people's measure, they would say that I'm successful now, right?
I would say so, yeah.
Well, but it really depends on who you're talking to. But to 99% of the world's population, I'm financially more successful than they are, right?
Mm-hmm.
By most people's social measurement, I've been happily married. It'll be 38 years in February.
Amazing.
So, I mean, I've got this great marriage. I've got four fabulous kids. My in-law kids are awesome. We've got all these grandkids that are just fantastic. I get to do what I want to do, and nobody's really telling me what to do, or I have a tremendous level of autonomy and control over my life. So that is what most people want. And mm-hmm. I want it too. And yet every time I get to some level, whatever you want to call it, I go, okay, so this is great. And what if I tweaked it this way? Or what if I could do this? Or what if I could put these people together? What could we make out of that? And it's not a matter of saying, I want more toys, or I'm not in some race to be some gazillionaire. However, I do feel compelled to do things that are interesting and add value. And the way you measure that in business is by dollars. You know, did you do something that the market wanted? And then they responded to you, and then you improve it and make it better, better, better. And then you either sit there and get fed by it, or you sell it. And you get a lump of money and you do the next fun thing. But at this stage of my career, and through most of my career, I've looked at things as projects that I'm working on, not like this be all end all, you know, business empire that is, I just don't think like that. I think like, oh, here's an opportunity. Let's mess with it. And if we do something well, we'll get paid for what we did. And then what do we want to do next? Because that's what the fun is do something, do it well, or if it doesn't work, get out of it and do something else that you can do well. And just, it's, I don't know, the fun part is the building and the things you learn by building for me.
I love that answer so much because you're following your passion, you're having fun, you're collaborating with other inspiring people. Like so many people out there, you're right, a lot of people want what you have. And it seems like so many people are like chasing the money, right? And it's like money is the end all be all, but that's not really what they want, right? They want the lifestyle. But I love that to you, money is just like a tool of measurement. Where it's like, okay, that means we did well, and go on. Am I wrong?
Yeah. No, that's right. No, I thank you for that. You're summarizing beautifully. I heard Warren Buffett in an interview one time. They asked him why he was giving so much of his money, almost all of his money, to the Gates Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and he said, if I tried really hard, maybe I could spend 1% of my money. The other 99%, and I loved how he said it, holds no utility for me. Hmm. Like, I don't need it. There's no, what do I do with this stuff? It's just baggage, right? I've got the life that I want to live. So beyond that, what is there? Well, maybe we should get it in the hands of people who can do something else with it. In my case, do I want to build opportunities for my children and grandchildren and subsequent generations? Absolutely. Do I want to? Well, I'll tell you, in our estate planning, my wife and I decided nobody's getting an inheritance. There's no money going that's going to get divided up. That's not going to happen. What is going to happen is there will be kind of like a family bank, like a corpus of money, and people can tap it to go to college or buy a house or start a business and then pay it back with interest back into the fund.
That's so smart.
but they'll get an opportunity to do stuff that maybe other people would struggle to get because there was no availability of funding, right? And so to me, the best thing to do is keep the money together and let the progeny dare greatly, and when they do, be able to have fuel to drive toward those goals, right? But then out of their success, or out of their, let's just say, as they get what they want, they start feeding it back in at a fair interest rate, not high interest rate, but just something fair that pushes money back in, so that when their kids or their grandkids need to get in, they can.
That's such a cool idea. And I love that you use the term dare greatly, because you want them to be dreamers. You want them to take on projects and follow their dreams. And I think that that's such an important thing to encourage people to do. So how does taking risks play into that for you? Are you a big risk taker? I know when you were 19, you didn't know the risk you were taking, but what about now?
I'm probably less risky and more strategic now than I had to be earlier in my career. There is definitely a reality between the greater the risk, the greater the success or failure, right? If you don't take much risk, you're not going to ever get much of a return. Mm-hmm. If you take a risk, you may lose everything, or you may win big, or you may break even. I mean, we don't know. But I think through the growth part of anybody's career or life, you will determine your future significantly by what are you doing from about 30 to 50 or 55. Like, what are you doing in that period? And how safe are you playing it? And if you're playing it safe, and if you have a job, you're probably putting money into a 401k or an IRA, or you've got a Roth IRA, or you're saving money, or you're paying off your home, so you're building equity. And that's all really, really good. And for the vast majority of the population, that's terrific. And for that huge percentage of people, listening to somebody like a Dave Ramsey is a really good thing to do, because it's all about controlling your debts and using money intelligently so that you get the greatest reward from your sort of fixed cash flow situation. Like, so you got a job, you got a paycheck, what are you going to do with it, right? Mm-hmm. For somebody like me, who's been figuring out how to make money for all of these years, for me, Dave Ramsey's approach is utterly wrong. It is completely wrong. For me, it's a matter of how can I have some level of safety net, and then some much bigger lever that I can work to accomplish something interesting. And thankfully, the older I get and the more success that I enjoy, and as people see that, I'm getting, it's almost like this is happening at an accelerating rate, where people are saying, will you help me? Will you like lend your experience in exchange for ownership in the company, in exchange for a monthly stipend to be a mentor to me? So I'm having to take less risks and get into diverse and interesting projects because I've just stuck it out long enough. And at least as far as the world can see, succeeded more than I've failed. Most people don't ever want to talk about their or somebody else's failures, unless you're in politics, and then they want to point out everything you ever did bad. But I'm not going to be in politics. And so, what's happening as I've kind of gotten into my later 50s and now 60, people keep coming to me and saying, can I just have you as a sounding board, and can you give me ideas? I was helping somebody earlier today who's gonna offer equity to a couple of key employees and had never done it, and just they're in my mastermind group and just wanted to know, how do you do it? And because I've been involved with taking, significantly involved, like being the chairman CEO of three public companies now, I know a little something about it. I'm not an expert, I'm not a lawyer, but I know enough that I can give somebody good counsel, and then people will pay for that, or people will either pay for it in partnership, pay for it in hourly. I don't like to trade time for money, and I've set a high dollar amount on it. At least I think it's high for me, for some people maybe, but it's to discourage people from wanting to just pick my brain. I'd rather have a half dozen things that I'm interested in and put my energy there, and not into lots of random kind of coaching, consulting calls. I don't consider myself a coach or a consultant, but I do consider myself a pretty good board member or advisor.
So, I mean, it sounds like also you want to be involved in the project, right? It's fun for you to kind of brainstorm with people and collaborate and figure that out. Or am I incorrect?
You're correct. What I've learned is, when I was young, I thought I could do anything. And as I've gotten older, that's gotten much more narrow. And now, as I stay in this narrow lane, people go, oh, he could help me.
Yeah. 'Cause
the broader you are, the harder it is for people to understand what value you bring to the party. Mm-hmm. The more narrow you are, the more like kind of more of an expert you are. And people go, oh, for that need, this person could be really valuable. And it becomes a much clearer relationship. And because it's clear, I can limit my scope of work to just what I'm really good at and not try to get into the middle of things that I kind of suck at, right? And it's much better to work on what you're great at than what you suck at. And when you do it, then everybody thinks you're brilliant. But if you try to get too broad, then you might do pretty good here, but kind of really crummy over here. And then people go, oh, it was a pretty good deal, pretty good relationship. But if you stay right here, they go, man, that person's brilliant, you know, and you shine better because you're not trying to get into things that one is not skilled or capable of doing.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So I want to talk a little bit about building businesses and build businesses that are successful and sustainable, and also, to use your own words, impactful, which I think is really great. How do you, like, what's your advice for someone that's just starting out that wants to build a business and maybe is just kind of starting or doesn't know where they're trying to go?
Well, okay. There's several pieces of very high level advice.
Okay.
First of all, in my opinion, there are three things that a business owner or aspiring business owner, any business owner needs in order to have a shot at being successful. Okay. They need to have, first of all, they need to have a thing, a product or service that the marketplace actually wants to buy. So a lot of people come up with cool ideas and then they want to push them onto the market and the market goes, I don't care.
Hmm.
You know? But they, to that individual, they think it's freaking brilliant and they really want to impose themselves onto other people and tell people they should be paying them for the thing that the buyer doesn't really get. Why would I care about this? Right? So first, identify something that there's a felt need in the market and that you have some mechanism to deliver it better or faster or cheaper than somebody else. And you can, you know, you can have two of those things, right? You can't have better, faster, cheaper in almost any situation, but you can usually have two of them. You can be better and faster, better and cheaper, cheaper and faster, right? But you're probably not going to be the best and the cheapest.
Sure.
Okay. All right. So number one is have something that there's any chance in the world of actually people being able to resonate quickly and understand it and go, you know, be interested. Second thing is you need to have enough money available to you in some way, shape, or form. That could be your mom and dad are loaning you money, you borrow money from your home equity, you've got money in savings, maybe you go get an investor, put it on credit cards, but you just need to have some mechanism that you can sustain yourself long enough for your product or service to get some engagement and start generating cash flow. So you've got to be able to eat. You don't have to get rich. You don't need a big fat salary while you're doing it. As a matter of fact, you don't deserve a big salary. Right. You don't even necessarily deserve to get paid. You deserve to, if you're trying to tell the world that they should engage you, then you should do everything in your power to make the business valuable before you feed yourself. But there's got to be enough money that it can get going and you can survive. Now, remember, Mark Cuban said that when he was trying to get off the ground, he would sometimes go into a McDonald's and he didn't have enough money to buy a cheeseburger. Mm-hmm. So he would grab a handful of the ketchup packets and squeeze those into his mouth.
Wow.
The old adage of, you know, live now like nobody else will, so someday you can live like nobody else can. It's a true thing. when I go into work with a business owner, my first question is, they say, here are my goals. And I look at their financials and I say, are you willing to take a pay cut? It's always in the first conversation, and they always say no, or they virtually always say no. I say, okay, then it's going to be much more expensive for you to grow than if you're willing to take a pay cut and use that money for the growth. You know, it's funny. We've got to take care of the company first and ourselves second.
And right? How long of a runway do you recommend to your clients to have?
I don't make a recommendation. Here's why. Some things you can get off, depending on what resources you have, money, connections, a big felt need. Like right now, AI is everywhere. Because even though some of us are going, well, I've been messing with AI for well over a year now, maybe a couple of years. Other people are going, I don't even know what it is. I've heard, you know, is this like Terminator? Like, what is this? Is this the singularity? Is this where the rise of the machines? You know, they don't have any clue. They've never messed with ChatGPT or any of the platforms. They have no idea. So right now, just saying artificial intelligence is almost like saying, you know, there's gold in them thar hills. Everybody rush to the mountain, you know, and start digging. Right now, you can get almost anybody to salute an AI flag. Right. But if you talk about less exciting things like it's the end of the year, you know, we got a month left. This is the time that you should be finalizing your tax planning for next year. Most people don't go, oh, that's so exciting. Right. Even though that would probably save them real money if they do it now instead of doing it on January 2nd, right? They'd probably save a bunch of money, but it's not as interesting. So they'll go after something that's exciting and shiny. How much runway do you need? It depends on how quickly you can get people to pay attention to you and how long it's going to take you to develop a minimum viable product that somebody will pay for. So what I'm saying is, for as long as you're willing to stay in the game, you need to be able to eat. And you can eat ketchup packets. It's okay. But you don't have to eat well. You don't have to be in a beautiful apartment. You don't even have to drive a car. I saw a video yesterday by a guy that I know who was posting, and he was standing by the bathroom in the back of the Southwest Airlines plane. And he was on the plane, and Joe Polish, whom I pay $35,000 a year to be part of the Genius Network that Joe started. And Joe and this guy were both on Southwest Airlines. You don't have to fly private or fly first class all the time to prove that you're successful. You know, how are you willing to live? What are you willing to spend on and not spend on? That will determine how long you can survive. So that's the second thing. Have enough money to survive the machinations of starting up. The third thing is, I recommend, and most people don't do it, is have a plan or a formula that you follow. Because people say, what have you learned from dozens of multi-million dollar companies that you've started or fixed? And I say three letters, S-R-A, same rules apply. Basically, what works in one company is going to work in almost every other company, as far as the big chunks of define what the outcome is, figure out what role I can play, then how do I augment my strengths with people that are strong at things that I'm weak at? How do I get those people on board? How do I keep score on those people? How do I build a culture that will foster innovation and collaboration? How do I measure that through good financials? How do I empower my management team to do work so I don't have to be there to babysit them and micromanage them day in and day out? Yeah. That's the whole premise of The Unshackled Owner, whole premise of the book, is that basically I had one client for The Unshackled Owner class who we'd taken from $1.5 million a year in revenue to almost $50 million a year in revenue in 4 years. And he said, we need a book. And I said, why do you need a book? You got this from the course. He said, because I live in Eastern Europe And the average business or the average engineer here makes $500 a month. They can't afford a $7,500 course, but they can afford a $20 book.
Yeah.
We need a book. And I said, good, let's make a book. It was never about, I never did a bestseller campaign. I didn't do anything to try to like make a big splash with the book. It's yeah. like, we need this to get it in the hands of more people so they can have a shot at winning. Good. Let's make a book. And thankfully, we found a nice New York publisher to publish it for us. And it's in all the bookstores and it's doing great. But the goal there was to put a plan, a formula that's a proven recipe, not the proven recipe, but a proven recipe where if you do step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you have very predictable results.
Amazing. And that's the power of books, by the way. Like you get to see, like boil down someone's genius, right? In like 200 pages. So if there's anyone listening that doesn't read, like go pick up Unshackled Owner, go pick up a bunch of business books because that's such a gift from those people who have walked the path.
I've read or listened to a lot of business books. By the way, for those that are listening, if you are not, you don't have to, you know, they say, people say, oh, I read, you know, a book a week or a book a day or a book a month or whatever, and they kind of brag about it. My deal is there's a million gazillion books out there that are not really that great. Like there's a whole bunch of crummy books out there. Find books that are written by people who have accomplished things you want to accomplish. You don't need to read everybody's book. It's not that there's not a great idea in that book, but figure out, instead of shotgunning to get success, get focused on a specific target and then go toward that target in as you know, laser focused a way as you can, instead of like kind of wandering around, groping around in the dark. You know, get information about what you need to accomplish your goal. And you'll find that as you study the words of these people who've gone before you and succeeded, that if you have that systems brain thinking, you will start to take disparate things that you've learned and put them together in an amalgamation that none of those authors taught you to do.
Right.
Then it becomes your thing because you learned enough stuff and your brain naturally puts rando pieces together into something that nobody else is doing. And that becomes your unique value to the market. The other thing is, I mean, Unshackled is a book that's written about what I've learned along the way and applied and proven that it works. So yeah. Do you think I made it all up? No, I got it from everybody I've learned from through the years. And as I gained information that made sense to me, I applied it and iterated on it until it fit into my way of the context through which I see, or the lens through which I see the world. It had to work for me. And then it got good enough that I saw it didn't just work for me, but it worked for lots and lots of employees. And then I saw, oh, it works for some of these big companies that are paying me $25,000 a day to come sit with them. Well, maybe it'd work in a course. Well, then hundreds and hundreds of companies, including really big companies, went through the course. A lot of public companies went through the course. And law firms and accounting firms and Indian nations and all kinds of people and organizations went through the course. And then I thought, maybe it'll work in a book. And now way more people, many, many thousands and thousands of people are now reading it in a book. And I'm learning, same rules apply. This system works. Is it the only way? No. Does it work? Yes. If you have a recipe for chocolate chip cookies and you follow it, you will get chocolate chip cookies. You won't get sourdough bread. You won't get, a bicycle. You'll get chocolate chip cookies. Oh, they may not be the best chocolate chip cookies in the world,
but they will be chocolate chip cookies, because if you follow a recipe, you'll get predictable results. And as you learn to understand why you're doing things, and then, you know, tweak it a little bit to fit in your circumstance, then you now created a mechanism to follow a recipe in this circumstance that produces really, really good results. That was my very long answer to what's the high level. You need to have a great product or service idea. You need to have enough money to live, and you need a plan to follow so that you don't waste time on a whole bunch of things that will not work. Just follow a plan that's been proven thousands of times now. And you know, guess what? It's probably going to work.
Amazing. And it's so smart to just get like laser focused, read the things that are going to help you, right? Now, I like not do the shotgun approach. And I really appreciated what you were saying about how, you know, as you read all these things, your brain connects things. Because I've had the thought before, but I haven't been able to like so eloquently put it as you did, where you're taking all this information that like other people probably aren't going to read the same books that you are. They're probably not going to work with the same mentors that you are, but then you get to synthesize that information for people, right? So then like you have all this value for people, right? Because it's become your unique thing. So I really appreciated that. As you were talking, one of the things you mentioned is fostering a culture and empowering your management. So, and as you know, like I'm co-directing the Leadership Academy for the Los Angeles Tribune. So leadership is on my mind. I literally was just on there live, like right before this. So I'd love to just hear a little bit about qualities of leaders that you think is important and how you create that culture and empower people.
Well, far be it from me to tell anybody else how to run their business. So, because when I look at people that I think do a really good job, I think of people that are fairly, I think Steve Jobs was a phenomenal leader, but he was pretty broadly, I'll be blunt. I mean, he just pissed a lot of people off.
Yeah.
You know, because nobody was going to get a trophy working for Steve Jobs. It's like, do a great job and don't expect me to fawn all over you, because you're here to do a great job. Right. So that is a way to be a leader, to set a very high standard and everybody's mostly failing. And when they do hit it and you go, good work. They just think the whole, like, you know, it's like Jesus just came down and anointed them, right? It's so that's a way to do it. Then there are other ways, like there's a guy named Bob Iger who runs Disney. He ran Disney. He went away and was just on the board. And then they got into all kinds of trouble and they asked him to come out of retirement and go back on. Now, you may or may not like Bob Iger and everything that's happening at Disney, but let me tell you what, Bob Iger is very clever at empowering leaders and then just tweaking those people, just tweaking them a little bit to keep them on target. And he's got a very complicated world with him, with Disney parks, Disney hotels, Disney pictures, Disney Plus television. Then you've got ABC and ESPN and everything else. You know, they just bought 20th Century Fox. They own Marvel. They own Star Wars universe, right? They bought all these things, and he's got people leading all of those things, and he is a very good gentle puppet master, where you don't really see any strings. He just sort of kind of through a little telekinesis can just slightly move somebody. What is the old thing about if you get on an airplane in like Los Angeles and you fly to Hawaii, fly to, let's say, to Oahu, to Honolulu, the plane is off course like 98% of the time, right? It's just the pilot or the autopilot just is constantly tweaking it in little minor degrees so it lands exactly on the strip of asphalt that it's supposed to, right? Not pretty close, not in the ocean, not on some freeway, not on the next island over, but exactly where you want to land, exactly where it's supposed to go. Because they don't yank it and pull it. They just slight little shifts. And that's something that Bob Iger is really great at. And it's sort of the way I try to lead as well, which is through gentle persuasion, through setting a standard and reminding the leaders, not by going, hey, what the hell's wrong with you? But to go, one of the things, in order to accomplish this, we are going to have to become a new version of ourselves to go to a new place that we've never been before, right? So, you know, Chris, what will you be doing to rise up to the occasion, to be prepared to go from being a $1 million company to a $10 million company, or $10 million to $100 million, right? Like, is this, and are you prepared to make that improvement in yourself? Or if you're satisfied here, great, and we'll help you find another company that is of the ilk where you want to live. But this company's moving on, right? And you don't have to be a threat. You just have to say, here's what is happening. What role or what tact do you want to take in order to either say, hey, I'm good where I am. I'm happy to stay here. And I know you're going to outgrow me. And either I'll take a lesser position in the company or I'll go elsewhere. Or say, no, I want to be a part of this trajectory. So I'm going to do things to become more self-aware, be a better leader, be a better measurer, be a better delegator, be a more creative collaborator, you know, those are things to do. So I don't know. Leadership to me is about figuring out what is your natural gift. How do you work with other people? How do you see the opportunity? How do you imagine, as the leader, the rest of the team is just an appendage of you, right? It's more arms, legs, eyes, ears, mouth. It needs to become a representation of the owner and the values and the things the company stands for and stands against. If people don't resonate with that, they will wash themselves out. They will go away from that, right? So eventually you've got a whole team of people who understand that their contribution matters and that it's in alignment with the values of the company, and that the owner or leader, whoever the leader is, the team sees that person as the very best possible example of these values. And they want to live up to that. They want to be a part of something that cool, versus a place where you have a leader that just whoops on people all the time and there's high turnover and they're just kind of a tyrant. I don't think that's leadership. I think that's manipulation. And eventually it'll work for a while, but eventually it just will fail. Because, you know, as in the olden days, the peasants will rise up and kill you. You know, at some point, if you whoop on them too hard, or the Boston Tea Party, you tax us too much, we'll go to war. You know, this is just, it's now too much. So I'd rather never get to that point. I'd rather be in a place where everybody goes, I don't know if I've given enough of my heart to this, because I really want this to be great. And then, of course, we want people to go have a life too, because the time they spend working for us is to earn the money to pay for the discretionary part of their life. So as leaders, we want to wildly support our people in living out the best, most happy life they can get.
I love that little aside that you put at the end. And it's so smart because it's like you're putting it in their hands, right? You're making the choice up to them. And when people believe it's their choice, it's kind of like you were saying earlier, like you don't want to let anyone down, right? Like that is such a motivator, right? They're like, everyone else around me is rising up. Like I want to rise up too. Like I want to show them that I'm not the thing that's going to like drag the ship down, right? That's so smart. And I love that you also support people's work-life balance, because like you said, like we're not here on this earth to just work and make money and eat and sleep and go to bed and start all over again, right? Like we're here to have experiences as human beings and to live life. And I think a lot of what you're talking about is having a really high EQ as well, right? Like having that emotional intelligence. Like, would you agree with that?
Yeah. First of all, not everybody should be a leader. Not everybody should be an owner. Not everybody should try to, there's no particular nobility in being an entrepreneur. It's a choice if you have what I think of as a little bit of a mental illness that leans towards taking tremendous risk, hoping for a big reward, knowing that you're going to fail more often than you succeed, right? It's why I get a little frustrated when the media beats up on business owners. They say, oh, these business owners are so greedy, or these corporations are so corrupt. And it's like, man, do you know how people were talking about Elon Musk? And I'm like, how many things does this guy have to do that are basically were thought to be generally impossible? How many magical things does this guy have to do for people to just leave him alone and let him keep being creative? You know, he's the Thomas Edison of our time. And just leave the guy alone. He's the freaking richest man in the world because he keeps delivering things that people want. And they're going, oh, well, he's now over there with the Trump and the right, you know. Well, he's a Democrat who's given us all electric vehicles, the thing the Republicans keep saying are stupid, right? The whole EV thing wouldn't really be happening without Elon Musk, right?
I couldn't agree more. I think he's a genius, and we talk about him in the Leadership Academy as like an example. So I love that you just called that out, because it's like he's doing good things for humanity also, right? It's not like he's out there
paid for it. People go, oh, that seems good. I want to invest my money in that person or that company that just kind of keeps hitting home runs. You know, anybody that grew up, anybody that's my age that watched the Apollo missions, right? I did not see, oh my gosh, Neil Armstrong step off and say, you know, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. I was alive, but it was the middle of the night. My parents didn't wake me up to see it. But I did watch, the subsequent ones, cause you know, I was 5 years old when Apollo 11 happened, but as 12, 13 and so on happened, and they started taking the lunar rover up and they're going to drive around. I was getting up Saturday mornings and watching cartoons as a little boy and seeing what was happening. The rockets just went away as space junk. And then the capsule flopped down in the ocean, and they had to go pick up with a Navy ship, go pick up the astronauts, right? Well, no, Elon Musk doesn't do that. Elon Musk sends his rocket up, it delivers the payload, and it comes back and lands at the same place. And then they kind of, you know, wash it up and put more fuel in it. And then 2 weeks later, they send it again. This is freaking amazing.
Yeah.
It's freaking amazing. And, why does he need to send satellites, or rockets up? Because he's delivering satellites and creating Starlink. So now anybody in the whole planet can get fast internet, no matter where you are, no matter if they can ever run fiber to sub-Saharan Africa or to the mountains of Peru, right? They get up in, everybody now with a smartphone can get high-speed internet. because Elon Musk is making it happen. And some people would argue, some people would argue against, and some people would argue for, but he spent whatever, over $40 million to buy Twitter, right? Or maybe was it 40 million, 400 million? I can't remember how it was, a lot, whatever it was.
He's not making money on that.
No, no, but whatever, I'm sure I grossly undervalued what he paid for Twitter. People could argue that he's doing it to preserve free speech. Other people could argue that he's doing it so he's got the loudest, you know, megaphone in the world. Whatever the case is, he owns it. Whatever the case is, and you do enough good things to help enough people, and they reward you big enough, you can start to affect really significant change. I don't know what's going to happen with this government agency of, you know, this DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency. I don't know if that'll work or not. I'm not, but I hope it does.
Yeah.
I hope it does. Cause you know what? I have some companies that get paid by the government and I simultaneously play the game and we make the money that the government will pay for stuff. And I go, this is insanity what they're willing to pay for stuff.
Hmm.
Like, this is just the standard pricing. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll do it. But dang, the private sector would never pay for this.
Yeah, you see it from the inside. That's interesting.
So I hope he could, if he could cut 80% of the employees like he did at Twitter and not lose the functionality and usefulness of the platform, if he could do that and release a bunch of people into the private sector to work in helping build entrepreneurial businesses, I think that would be fantastic.
I do too. And he would create so many new jobs out of that. And Vivek is also super smart. The two of them together, I think, could do really great things.
Yeah. So
yeah, I hear you.
I don't want this to be a political point because I don't think either side has the moral high ground. I think they both play the same kind of games.
Yep.
And there's not a significant, there are a few things that they leverage, but mostly it's to rile people up to get them to vote. And then the people go into the positions of leadership and then they just do whatever they're going to do. They don't necessarily represent their state or their district. They represent what the party wants to do.
And the lobbyists, right?
Well, lobbyists provide the lubricant, you know, for the systems and the lubricant for the politicians to have a very soft landing when they leave politics. So you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. It's a somewhere between opportunistic and corrupt system.
That's a good way of putting it.
So I don't really trust the system, but my deal is I just pay attention to what is going on as unemotionally as possible and go, okay, based on whatever the power that be is working on, how do I arrange my affairs in such a way to get the best result during this season? And then if the power base shifts, how do I morph so we can deliver our products and services against the backdrop of this new narrative? It doesn't mean we even have to change what we're doing, but it does change how we're talking about it and to whom we're approaching as prospective affiliates or customers.
That's so smart. And I love that you just said it's not about changing what we're doing, but how we're talking about it, because that is, especially over the last like 4 to 8 years, that has been so important. How companies are showing up online, how they're talking about it, how they're like branding themselves to the public, like more than ever, right? Because people want to be able to relate to a company, right? Or they want to make sure the company aligns with their values more than ever. So that's really smart. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it is interesting. What's funny is that I don't give a lot of thought to, if I want to go to a grocery store, I'm not really evaluating, is the local privately owned store versus Safeway versus like a one of the Kroger products, you know, so where I live, Fred Meyer, I don't really evaluate what their politics or what their pay scale or what their, I don't, yeah. I'm going in there going, what experience do I want when I walk through those doors? Right.
And probably what products, right?
Well, I'm saying what experience do okay. I want? What experience yeah. do I want? Am I, because if they treat me great, but they have nothing I want, I'll go, oh, what a bunch of nice people, but that's not the store for me.
Yeah.
Right. But if I walk in and I can find what I'm looking for and I think the price seems fair and the store was clean and the people were friendly enough, you know, I'll probably go back in that door. But if they come to me and say, hey, welcome to our store. Here's a pamphlet on our political stance, what we invest our money in, who, what charities we give to, and so on. I'm going to do something besides going, I'll either go, I don't care, and throw it away.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they really want me to know it, I'll go, okay, I'll look. But that's not why I walked in the door. So
yeah.
I'm not coming back because you're now trying to make me care about what you care about. And guess what? I'll promise you this. I care what I care about. All of us do. All of us do.
Yeah.
When you drive down the freeway, Chris,
mm-hmm.
you know about the person you're talking to on the phone or the person you're going to meet or your friends and your family and your loved ones. And maybe, you know, maybe there's a couple hundred people in your sphere of consciousness, right? Most of whom you're not thinking about while you drive on the freeway, right?
Right.
And then there's everybody else on the freeway and everybody else in a house or business that you're passing that you're giving no thought to. In psychology, they call that undifferentiated other.
Hmm.
They're just nobody.
Background people.
They just happen to be there. And you don't know what their story is and you're not seeking to find out. That doesn't make you a bad person. That means you're working within the bubble of the world that you know about. And next to you, who's doing great work, you know, stuff for the community, is the person who's going to go rob the bank or who is selling fentanyl or is miserable and just showing up at some job they hate, you know. And their worlds are all different than Chris's world, I promise you, right? But you're not thinking about it because you're just doing your thing. When you get to wherever you're going, or when you're getting in your automobile and deciding, do I like how this car feels? Do I like how the radio sounds? Do I like how it drives? If you don't like it, you're going to look for a different answer, right?
Yeah.
When you go to do business with somebody else, what you want is what you want. And the thing to remember is every single customer or prospect that you're trying to have a better, more valuable relationship with, all they don't care about what you care about. They care about what they care about. Now, if you can be in alignment, that's great, but don't force that down their throat. A big part of leadership is leading your own team to provide value to your customers. That's what you're doing, to create value for whomever your customer is. And the better you do it, the more abundance you will experience. And out of your abundance, then go support whatever causes, whatever, anything you want to do, you can do out of the overflow of abundance of successfully reacting to the market. You become rich, you become Warren Buffett, and you can give one of the greatest fortunes on the planet, in history even, to all kinds of great causes that somebody else at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is thinking about, not Warren Buffett. He's like, I made all this money, I'm good, you guys take all these billions, have a great time, do something good with it. And he related to their mission, so he gave him a lot of money. The person that walks into your store or goes to your website or calls you on the phone is wanting the same thing. They want a good experience. Leadership is about building a team that provides value to the marketplace in such a way, in an efficient enough way, that there's something left over at the end of the day that the owner and whomever else are stakeholders benefit from. If you do that well enough, you become Elon Musk. You provide enough value to enough people, and out of your abundance, you can change the world. And if maybe it's not the whole planet Earth, maybe it's just your neighborhood. Maybe it's just your family. Maybe it's just the groups that you decide to throw in with. But you can make huge impact on the world around you if you do something that may not be your passion, by the way. I'm not very passionate about forming LLCs or doing corporate minutes and resolutions. And yet I've got tens of thousands of customers that tell me what a difference it makes in keeping them safe in a lawsuit or an audit, or when they get in a car accident or go through a business breakup, and how it was all organized so they were safe and they could operate from a position of strength, and they love it. And out of that success in doing something that's kind of boring, we create a lot of abundance.
Amazing. That was such a mic drop moment. And I'm so grateful that you came on today, because the value that you just provided to me in an hour, to our listeners in an hour, was just overwhelming. And I love everything you talked about with the highway metaphor, and it's so important. And I think it all boils down to authenticity too, right? Be authentic to yourself, and leaving it with, like, it doesn't have to be your passion, right? It has to be something that, like, you're good at, that you're serving, that you're providing, that you see in the market. And then you can also have passions on the side, right? We talk about how we're both passionate about horses. So I appreciate you so much. Thank you so much for your time. I'm sure people want to know where they can connect with you, where they can find the book, all the things. So if you wouldn't mind sharing.
They can, I guess there are several things. One, I would love it if people would buy the book. That would be great. I'll never know if they just go to Barnes and Noble or do you have one? Oh, there it is. All right. If you go to Barnes and Noble or Amazon, or anywhere it's sold, that's great. I know they're on shelves in lots of Barnes and Nobles. I went to my local Barnes and Noble, which is by the Portland airport. That's the closest one to me. And it's a small store, and they didn't have it on the shelf. And they said, can we help you find something? And I said, oh, I was looking for my book. And, you know, I know they carried in other bigger stores. I know this is one of the small concept stores. And the lady goes, let's go check the computer. Oh, we had six of them. They all sold out. We have more coming.
Hell yeah.
And I was like, yes. That was right after we were at the Grove, where they had four cases that, because they were selling through at the Grove, you know, that their flagship store. So hooray. And they've offered me this national book tour now. They've offered me to come travel across the country to go to the Barnes. Oh yeah. They asked me that night to do a national tour.
Hell yeah. Congrats. That's
isn't that wonderful?
So deserved. That's amazing.
So go get the book, or you can go to aaronscottyoung.com. Or you can go to LaughlinUSA.com, and somewhere in there you can find me. Or you can send me an email at AaronYoung@LaughlinUSA.com.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much again. It has been such a pleasure to have you on, and I'm so grateful for your time. If you are listening, please send this to someone you think would find it useful. Like, comment, share, subscribe. Let's all help elevate everyone else. Have a great rest of your day, everyone.